Right, this is Jason Horsley and the Liminalist, the podcast between. I'm picking up where I left off with Rossi Chait's The Witch Hunt Narrative, Politics, Psychology and the Sexual Abuse of Children. It's about a week later. In the interim, there's been the incident with this enactment of a satanic ritual sacrifice, or ritual sacrifice, I guess it wasn't explicitly satanic, at CERN, and I got very immersed, and am immersed in a discussion, that rigorous intuition about that. Other developments also that I won't go into, which all combined indicate that I seem to be getting drawn or just finding my way instinctively deeper into this, the labyrinth of the penundra, the maze of the Minotaur, of course with the hope of reaching the center where the exit is found, or however that works, going to the center of the earth, the core of the psyche, where the original sin implant was installed. But anyway, that's just a little context. I also have sores in my mouth, which would seem to relate to this. It would seem to be a somatic reaction, but whatever the case, they are somewhat interfering with my ability to speak and read, and hopefully not in too serious a way. In the book, The Witch Hunt Narrative, page 132, more or less, actually starting on page 130, Rossi Chait writes about the Friedman case, which became very widely known through Andrew Jarecki's movie Capturing the Friedmans, which is a movie that I saw around the time it came out and I liked very much. So I must have not found it to be overly dismissive of the question of organized abuse, otherwise I simply wouldn't have liked it. But I can't remember what I concluded by watching the movie, if I did, in terms of the Friedmans. I certainly felt that they were guilty, but whether I felt that they were part of a larger network, I don't recall. I imagine I would have suspected that, because I always do, but I don't remember thinking that the movie was concealing that or overtly slanting the evidence. But according to Chait's analysis of the data in the movie, that was in fact the case. There are various things he zeroes in on. One of which was that the film suggests that the victim testimony was elicited through hypnosis on more than one occasion. In fact, it's even debatable whether a single testimony was got through hypnosis, and certainly there's no evidence that the other ones were. I think the most damning thing is that Jarecki didn't talk to the majority of the alleged victims. He wasn't even sure how many. He said approximately 5 or more than 3. There were 15 in all. But Jarecki chose not to speak to them, for whatever reason. According to Chait, Jarecki also leaves out any mention of a third defendant outside the family who pleaded guilty. When confronted with the startling omission, Jarecki responded that this man, Ross Goldstein, did not want to appear in the film. But why this would prevent someone who was making a film they describe as a documentary from mentioning him has never been explained. Uh, anyway, and so on. So it does strongly suggest that Jarecki and his film deliberately obscured the facts around that, which is, I suppose, surprising insofar as the film seemed like a very good one, but it's not surprising in the larger context. I also discovered while reading this book that Sean Penn, of all people, produced a documentary in 2009 called Witch Hunt, which was about a supposed case of false accusations of sexual abuse of children, which does make me wonder in terms of Hollywood's complicity with all of this. So, moving to chapter 4 of the book, History Ignored, on page 151. The witch hunt narrative drowned out all accounts of social and legal responses to child sexual abuse in America during the McMartin era. There is no sense in the narrative that there were competing social forces concerning child sexual abuse during the period. There is no sense that at the same time there were problematic prosecutions, real child sex abuse was being minimized and denied. The idea of sex abuse hysteria is presented as if child sexual abuse went from not being reported to being overreported. The witch hunt narrative also conveys the idea that child sexual abuse went from being rarely punished to being all too severely punished. And it suggests that the so-called ritual daycare abuse cases began with the McMartin case. There is no recognition that there were proven cases of sexual abuse in daycare centers before the McMartin case, sometimes even including features that were later generally written off as fantastic. Page 155. The witch hunt narrative focuses on approximately one dozen cases from the middle to late 1980s. This national study suggests there were at least 20 times as many daycare sex abuse cases in just 3 of those years. In other words, there was one substantiated case for every 5 reports. This finding contradicts the claim by proponents of the witch hunt narrative that investigators are prone to find abuse wherever they look. Point is, these data do not bear out a story of overzealous investigators who always find sex abuse whether or not it exists. The witch hunt narrative offers no theory to explain these contrary results, since it never predicts lack of publicity or a decision not to prosecute cases that meet the standard for substantiation. So, in simple terms, the witch hunt narrative is the very opposite of what we know, at least from the recent developments in the UK, that by and large these cases go unreported, are covered up, are discredited, are ignored, are suppressed, and so on. The witch hunt narrative is the exact opposite of that, which is interesting that on the one hand you could say that it's a counter narrative and it has to match it, oppose it by presenting the very opposite argument and be strong enough to blot out the truth, but on the other hand you could also say that there's a symbiotic relationship between the two as a reality, which is that the more that these kind of things are denied and suppressed and covered up, the more there's going to be a corresponding pressure, agitation, reaction within people to not to fabricate or even necessarily to exaggerate, but to overreact, to overstress whatever it is that they are finding. Just as imagine, well, you don't have to imagine that whenever we're in a discussion with somebody and we're being stonewalled when that person is simply not hearing us and insisting that what we're saying is false without even listening, then we tend to overstate our case, we tend to overcompensate and begin to take a much more dogmatic and extreme position than we would otherwise. That's just part of human nature. It doesn't even have to be explained because we experience it so often. So on a collective scale, it's possible to see how whatever degree of satanic panic or witch hunt does exist or occur in reality, it can be understood as a reaction against the stonewalling of the truth and testimonies, I think. As opposed to the kind of no explanation, which is just that people panic, people have these fears and have these fantasies, and then they project them, but that never explains where the initial fear comes from. It was a case in the Bethel Baptist Church from Michigan, 1989, on page 159. Two juveniles were accused of molesting approximately 50 young children in the church nursery center between 1985 and 1988. This is precisely the kind of abuse the witch hunt narrative would claim is unlikely to have occurred over such a long period of time without someone detecting it or disclosing it, but that is what happened. The case is verified through the confession of the perpetrators. One of them revealed details during court-ordered therapy at a residential treatment facility. The other later pleaded guilty to criminal charges. These examples contradict the witch hunt narrative in various ways. They are most important for illustrating the difficulties in detecting and prosecuting this kind of abuse, even in the years when the witch hunt narrative claimed sex abuse hysteria was sweeping the country. The following page is where Chait states, the idea that a network of organized pedophiles infiltrated daycare centers in the 1980s deserves to be dismissed. Now, this, of course, was annoying to read, upsetting, enraging even. I actually haven't heard from Ross Chait or his publishers recently, even though they gave me, I haven't heard from Chait at all, but his publishers gave me a complimentary copy of this book, so they're clearly interested in me talking to the author and reading the book. But Chait himself hasn't replied to either of my emails, and lately the publishers haven't been responding either. But anyway, I was just saying that as frustrating as that reading that statement was, it being, I can't say factually wrong, because he's just expressing an opinion, he deserves to be dismissed, but it's based on an ignorance, giving benefit of the doubt anyway, of what has come to light in the UK, which is in fact that child care homes were infiltrated or even started by pedophile networks in order to have access to children. So there's no reason to dismiss it in the US. And why he would write that is the question of interest. Does he actually believe that, or does he simply feel the need to make it clear that he's not aligning himself or giving credence to the more extreme interpretations of what happened and the belief in an organized network of ritual abuse, because of course it doesn't take long if you follow that line of thought to end up on the very fringes of conspiratainment and lack all credibility entirely. So he may be signaling to the reader that it's safe, that he's not one of those crackpots, and therefore avoiding the risk of having the rest of the material dismissed. And or he may be signaling to his peers and his superiors, his subordinates in the academic community, that he's not going to address that, he's not going to threaten to uncover that particular narrative or that particular reality. Or he may just be ignorant. He may have tunneled his vision as a necessary kind of defense against what he was discovering, and just ignored any of the evidence for the organized nature of these things, or a combination of all of those things. I don't think he's lying, though. This book is too seriously researched, too grounded, and too sincere. He also describes himself, or mentions that he was abused as a child himself. He doesn't talk about how, but he suggests that there was no ritual or organized aspect to it. So I noticed a interesting contradiction right after he makes that statement, where he dismisses the sacrifice of babies, what does he say? Well, I can't find it. But anyway, he uses the idea of baby sacrifice as an example of a fantastic element. There it is. There are actually two kinds of fanatics in this debate. Ones who still cling to allegations of cult conspiracies and the sacrificing of babies, and those who deny all claims of ritualistic sexual abuse. So, he's there lumping baby sacrifice in with the crazy fanatics who cling to allegations that are clearly false. But then on the next page, he cites a case. The horrors were real, including a 9-month-old child who was murdered and buried on Sexton's command, etc., etc. So, how he chooses to distinguish between the sacrifice of babies and the murder of a 9-month-old child is not clear, particularly as that murder is in the context of devil worship of some kind, drinking deer's blood and rituals and whatnot. So it's pretty crazy, that kind of double thing. Page 63, prosecutor Kathleen Morris suspected, at least for a time, that there was baby killing in Jordan, Minnesota, without any reports of missing babies or evidence of their death. On the other hand, the witch hunt narrative has adopted the position that children's statements involving ritualistic elements that have been proven in real cases are nevertheless so bizarre as to discredit the child automatically. Well, so again, he's taking these two positions simultaneously as if to try and stay on solid ground while challenging the dominant narrative and saying that we can't dismiss things as just bizarre. We can't dismiss things because they seem bizarre. Well, but on the other hand, his argument against baby killing is simply that there were no reports of missing babies, and that just seems like a very weak argument. Like, the notion that a pregnancy could occur in secret is not a very radical or incredible notion. And that's even without going into breeding programs and things that have been testified to, which perhaps do stretch credibility. Well, for some of us it's easy to see why that would be hard to believe that, but somebody just keeping a pregnancy secret is not hard to believe at all. They just don't have to leave the house for a month or two, and even then they could cover it up. So yeah, that's ridiculous. Very weak argument based on, seems like, just an emotional resistance to an idea and a desire not to be associated with a certain set of supposed fanatics. And he cites an interesting thing in this section, the child pornography myth. Lawrence Stanley coined the phrase child pornography myth in an article in Playboy magazine. But then it turns out that Stanley was himself a child pornographer, which should come as no surprise. writing for Playboy. And he's citing specific cases here, and the discrepancy between the idea of a witch hunt, in which people were charged and prosecuted unfairly and over too severely and all that, with the reality. At the same time, Southern Florida was supposedly in the grips of hysteria over child sex abuse. Jack Shaver received probation in exchange for his guilty plea, which was child pornography. At least, I'd have to go back to know he was an actual predator. Well, yeah, he worked at a daycare centre. So, yeah, and was using the children now, it seems, for pornography. So, yeah, he just got a probation for that. So no witch hunt there. A similar case in Massachusetts bears out the connection between daycare abuse and child pornography, and the difficulty in getting people to take it seriously. Amazing, isn't it? That anyone, even back in the 80s really, could have found it hard to take the idea of child pornography seriously. A mother of five who prosecutors claim made $500,000 per year by supplying child pornography across the country had a customer list of 30,000 people. Wilson distributed films with titles such as Little But Lewd and Kinda Orgy. A jury deadlocked 11-1 for conviction after the first trial, prosecutors moved ahead with a retrial and Wilson ended up pleading guilty to a single count of child pornography. One might wonder, in light of these cases, how Lawrence Stanley supported his oft-cited claim of a child pornography myth. The answer is partly that Stanley was describing how effective law enforcement officials had been in driving commercially produced magazines such as Lollytots, Baby Love and Nudist Moppets out of the market. What replaced that market was a thriving cottage industry that creates its own pornography and distributes it through an informal but extensive underground. This is what Stanley minimizes. A close reading of his award-winning article in Playboy reveals that Stanley's own estimates contradict the idea of a child pornography myth. After debunking some overstated claims about the size of the child pornography business, Stanley allowed that a small, essentially insignificant group, by some estimates as few as 5,000 people, are involved in child pornography. Stanley does not consider child pornography to be a social harm in the first place. It is no wonder he minimizes the size of the industry. What is surprising is how many others have relied on him as some kind of expert. Stanley is a self-proclaimed girl lover who produced a variety of magazines with pedophile themes, sold pictures of young girls at nudist camps, and produced a newsletter called Uncommon Desires, a voice of a politically conscious girl love underground. This discussion of ritual elements in child pornography is probably the section of this book that is most likely to be misrepresented by proponents of the witch hunt narrative. The narrative uses a kind of guilt by association to discredit cases and people by associating them with credulous acceptance of all sorts of ritual abuse. Well, yes, and that's clearly what Jake is terrified of happening to his case, or at least being very careful to avoid. I would say too careful. By far. Anyway. And moving on to page 181, there's a interesting quote here from an assistant prosecutor in Delaware. Nice guys make good child sex abusers. Kids don't like mean, nasty guys. And Tate continues, neither do the adults who are critical to gaining access to children. Nathan's way of thinking is precisely what pedophiles bank on. Nathan is a reference to... Debbie Nathan argued that these cases were impossible to believe, in part because the alleged perpetrators were white and middle class. In short, the last people you'd associate with sleazy, trench-coated pedophiles. Of course, that has changed quite a lot now, in the last few years, but there's still a basic assumption. Anyway, finishing this quote, Nathan's way of thinking is precisely what pedophiles bank on, that they appear to be so unlikely to have sexual interest in children that any allegations to this effect are quickly dismissed as improbable. I don't know if there's much to add to that that I haven't already said. I'll just move on. First, some children are just too young to testify. The Maine Supreme Court overturned the conviction of a man who confessed to child molestation, reasoning that without the young child's testimony, it was not clear that a crime had been committed. In a 1992 case in Delaware, state prosecutors gave a man his freedom in exchange for a signed statement admitting that he repeatedly had raped his daughter when she was three. The agreement caused such an outcry that the Attorney General released a statement explaining the difficulties in prosecuting such cases. Evidence of prior acts, though undoubtedly relevant to assessing allegations, is generally considered too prejudicial to defendants to allow into evidence. The Miami Herald described a case in which a father of four was being tried for assaulting an 11-year-old girl who had been riding her bicycle. The jury, which ultimately settled on a lesser offense, was not allowed to be informed of the defendant's conviction 5 months earlier for assaulting a different 11-year-old girl on a bicycle. I think that there's something about the legal system, that, leaving aside the distinct possibility that it's being designed and maintained by criminals and abusers in order to protect them, just leaving that aside, there's something about the legal system that prevents it from being effective in a true sense in terms of justice. I mean, in general, of course, but specifically around cases of child sexual abuse. The first one mentioned here is that children are often too young to testify, even if they do remember and even if they're willing to. And, of course, if the parents are willing to put them through the kind of ordeal that it entails, they may be too young to be coherent and to be credible. Generally, children are not believed, so this goes beyond the legal system, of course, the whole social system, of which the legal system is just a sort of concentrated area or structure within it. There's that. The other, I think, relates to the nature of the crimes being so triggering, I'm going to say that word, as opposed to so morally offensive, because those are two very different things, and this relates to the quote that I cited. I think it's coming up actually here. Here it is. The sexual abuse of children is a crime that our society abhors in the abstract but tolerates in reality. Well, all the moral indignation in the world doesn't amount to one shred of justice when it doesn't lead to action, when it remains in the abstract. So I think that the moral indignation and outrage, it would be more accurate to say that people get triggered and they have an extreme emotional response which they then kind of recalibrate into a moral position in order to somehow buffer it. So in the case, in the example cited here, that generally trials don't permit a defendant's prior convictions as evidence because they're so damning. I mean, they so prejudice the jury against the accused. Basically, what that's saying is it's just too charged, because the idea that a legal system that's based on evidence and deduction and reasonable doubt and all of that wouldn't allow the evidence of prior behaviors of a repeat offender It doesn't make any sense except in that context that this material is simply too charged so juries can't think about it impartially, and because of that, the system itself protects the perpetrators. It's like the society protecting itself from that awareness and that experience, which of course is what it comes down to, is that adults who have some kind of profound trauma in their past are not able to approach that trauma without reacting emotionally, unconsciously, and irrationally, and trying to shut down the awareness that's emerging. So, whenever these crimes come up, the ability to approach them rationally, logically, and faithfully to a kind of legal, a legal criteria and standard, that all goes out the window. So then there's the quote about this tolerance, and then the strongest and most direct evidence for tolerating child sex abuse is the extent to which respectable child molesters are embraced and supported even after they are proved guilty. So charges dropped against an offender, a pretty much proven offender here, with the greatest reluctance, according to the judge, because the statute was considered unconstitutionally vague. When it came time to sentence Donahue, who pleaded guilty, Judge Charles A. Porter Jr. noted the disturbing fact that collectively this community knew what was going on. Incredibly, the judge argued that Donahue should not be made a scapegoat for what happened, as if his crimes were committed by someone else. The judge sentenced him to 1 year in prison. Donahue served 8 months. So, here there's the overlap between the society that tolerates the child sexual abuse, the community, let's say, and then the legal system that is somehow inhibited from pursuing justice in these cases because of the community's tolerance. It's seen as if the community tolerated it, then they failed in their duty, and the perpetrator somehow isn't solely guilty because his behavior was actually being tolerated and implicitly condoned by the community in which he existed and committed those crimes, and therefore the legal system balks at actually imposing the justice that the community itself ought to have imposed. It's ironic because, of course, vigilante justice is not considered, but it's not indicating that the community should have punished the perpetrator, but simply that they should have challenged and exposed him and his crimes, reported him, and all the rest of it. Certainly, the community is complicit in this example and countless other ones. So it would be more, it seems like it'd be more accurate if the judge were to talk about how it seems unfair to sentence this one person when clearly a large portion of the community was complicit and ought to be on trial here too. Yes, but to then extend that to, we're going to let this person off because he's not solely guilty, he's part of a larger complex of complicity that enabled his actions, doesn't really make a great deal of sense. But then to take it even further to say that this person's being scapegoated for the community's crimes, well, that's a very strange position. It's almost like a psychological one or a metaphysical one, saying that this perpetrator was only acting out the unconscious of the community for it, and so hence the community was complicit in that. So he should not be scapegoated by the community, but the legal system isn't the community. So that's a strange leap right there. Anyway, I'm too tired for this. I don't think my brain is functioning. I'm just gonna keep doing it because you never know. Richard Gardner, who coined the phrase sex abuse hysteria, made an empirical claim in the Wall Street Journal that our society has become so hysterical about child sex abuse that child molesters on average serve longer prison sentences than murderers. Gardner claimed that his references were available on request, but his response to a request from this author produced only an example of one long sentence, Robert Kelly's in the Edenton, North Carolina daycare abuse case. Comprehensive examination of all sentences for murder and for child molestation over a 9-year period in Rhode Island revealed that Gardner's claim was extremely exaggerated. Child molesters often receive probation, but murderers never do. Child molesters often receive minimal sentences, but murderers almost never do. It is a testament to the uncritical acceptance of the witch hunt narrative that Gardner's exaggerated claim was published in the Wall Street Journal without documentation or subsequent correction. Samuel L. Jones, an airport official, received probation after pleading guilty to felony charges of lewd and lascivious acts with pre-teenage boys. This man could not suffer more consequences than he already has, his lawyer told the court, employing a logic that would insulate anyone with an important job from actually having to go to prison. What this is suggesting is that he lost his job, and that because he lost his job, the court had mercy on him, saying that that was suffering enough for his crimes, which puts the machinery of justice clearly in the context of class. A poor person who is charged and convicted of a similar crime is punished. They don't lose their job, they don't have a job to lose, or if they do, it's not considered a major loss, hence they're punished. A more high status, high class person, it's considered sufficient punishment, the fact merely that they're reduced in status. Conclusion 1 on page 196. The McMartin preschool case came to define an era of child sex abuse cases that began in 1983 and drew to a close in the early 90s. These cases coincided with the recognition of child sexual abuse in America. This is an important thing. Few critics seem to remember what was being asked of these people at the time of the McMartin scandal. To respond to a problem that was suddenly recognized as serious with little guidance and few precedents, i.e. that they were also made aware of child sexual abuse as a reality throughout history. Second, there were powerful forces of secrecy and denial that explain why sexual abuse was not recognized before the mid-1980s. Those who promoted the witch hunt narrative arising during this time never confronted what it meant that sexual abuse had been ignored or dismissed for so long. There were multiple reasons for the deafening silence around this issue. These perpetrators of abuse rely on secrecy, and they are skilled at coercing children into silence by various means. Okay, that's it. This is not going to be a podcast. It's just some notes and quotes for those who haven't read the book and want to, or don't want to, either way, but can get some sense of what's in it.